she made no effort to perk up her sleepy voice.
"This is Catherine King."
"Miss King? Andy Scholl here. I apologize for calling so late."
"Who?"
"Andy Scholl, Metro Desk."
The woman sat up slowly, rubbing her eyes.
"Metro? Sure," she said,
but she'd never heard of this guy.
"What can I do for you, Andy?"
"Again, sorry about the hour, but I'm doing a story on a double homicide in Washington Highlands, and I could use your professional opinion."
Catherine lay back down on her right side.
"The butler did it. Can I go back to sleep?"
Andy chuckled.
"I can pretty much guarantee this dump didn't have a butler." "No, actually I'm calling because I was told the CIA was here, looking over the crime scene. I haven't run into that before, so I thought I'd reach out to you."
Catherine King sat back up.
"Hold on. Are you saying agency personnel are investigating a homicide in the district?"
"That's the word I got. The dick who made the scene first."
"I beg your pardon."
"Sorry, the detective said he was told the men inside were Homeland Security. He didn't outright say CIA, but that was his inference."
"What's the connection to Langley?"
"I don't have a clue, and it doesn't seem like the cops do either. The crime scene is a suspected Aryan Brotherhood property, but I don't know if that's relevant or not. I do know you are the paper's veteran national security correspondent, so I thought maybe you could help, since nobody knows more about the intelligence community in this town than you do."
King picked up on the platitude, and it told her something about this Andy Scholl. Cops reporters were usually either grizzled old vets, or else they were young and ambitious. Scholl, it was clear, was the latter, and he was sucking up to her a little. She absolutely hated to be called a veteran reporter. She found this almost as bad when she was referred to as an institution, which also happened on occasion. But she was too intrigued by Andy's information to be either flattered or annoyed.
"I can't think of a soul on that side of the Anacostia who would be of interest to CIA. I suppose if they are counter-intel officers and they caught one of their people visiting a drug house, then that would rouse Langley in the middle of the night, but that's just a guess."
"It was one male with bodyguards, and one female. I got pretty good pictures of both of them."
"You did you? You need to be careful doing that with agency personnel. They are camera shy as a species. Did they see you take their picture?"
"Absolutely not."
"You want to send them to my phone?"
"On the way."
Catherine reached for her eyeglasses, then turned on the light on her nightstand. While she waited, she looked around her bedroom. She lived alone and had no children, so the only disorder in the home was her own. An empty cereal bowl and a spoon on the nightstand, a pile of yoga tights and sweats on a settee in a far corner, a raincoat lying over a chair by the door to her closet. She'd returned from a trip to Cairo 3 days earlier, where she'd been meeting with a source in Egyptian intelligence, and she'd yet to unpack fully, so a large, rolling, north-face duffel sat on a table in the far corner of the room, open with dirty clothes spilling out onto the floor. Two images appeared on her mobile, and Catherine looked at them one at a time. She zoomed in on the first, a woman with light brown hair in a tight bun. She did not recognize her. She swiped down to the next image. This one was of a white-haired man in his early 50s. He seemed to have a two-man security detail shadowing him. Interesting. If he was CIA, this would be beyond odd. Other than the director and some division heads, CIA execs didn't ordinarily move with bodyguards in the USA. She blinked away more sleep and quickly rubbed her eyes. She looked at the photo of the white-haired man again. After several seconds, she said,
"That makes no sense at all."
Though she was talking to herself, Scholl asked, "Do you recognize them?"
"The gentleman with the white hair is Jordan Mays. I haven't seen him since Iraq, 6 years ago. Back then he was a senior officer, but now he's assistant director of the CIA's National Clandestine Service."
"Does that mean he's a big deal?"
"Big enough to where I can't think of a single reason he would be wandering through a crime scene in the middle of the night in the worst part of the city. Why would anyone do that?"
With a little hesitation, she said,
"Hope that doesn't offend you, Andy."
Not in the least. We can't all get the good gigs like the national security beat.
The comment barely registered with Catherine. She was still looking at the picture of Jordan Mays. She said,
Mays's purview is 100% outside of the U.S. Denny Carmichael holds Mays's leash.
Who?
Carmichael runs the show at CIA.
Director?
Directors don't run the show, Andy. Directors are political hires, sent in to watch over, but to keep their hands clean. No, Denny Carmichael is the head of the National Clandestine Service. He's the top spook in Spookland. He does all the dirty things around the world.
He's bad?
Depends on your perspective. He's done a lot of good, I'm sure, but I've watched while Denny has grown his fiefdom to the point where he makes his own rules over at Langley. I'm not crazy about that.
Are you going to ask Carmichael what his assistant was doing in Washington Highlands?
Catherine thought this over.
No, that's not the right play here. I'd rather probe into Mays a little. Figure out who this woman is with him at the crime scene. If I go to Carmichael as clueless as I am now, he'll know he can sell me anything. Once I have some facts, just enough to scare him into thinking I know more than I really do, I'll confront him.
Andy didn't respond to this. Finally, Catherine said,
Did I lose you?
There was obvious amazement in his voice.
That's genius. I talk to men and women who lie for a living. You develop techniques to mitigate some of the BS along the way. Will you keep me posted on anything you learn about the Highlands incident?
Of course I will. What would you say to the two of us sharing a byline?
Catherine smiled at the phone.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Andy. I don't know there is a story there just yet. I get 5 can't-miss earth-shattering leads a week that turn into nothing. For now, let's just pull this thread from both ends and see what turns up. That sound good to you?
Sounds great. I'll let you know what I find.
Catherine King hung up the phone, pulled off her glasses, and lay back down on the bed. But after 30 seconds, she rolled back up, climbed to her feet, and headed downstairs to her home office. Whatever was going on that involved spooks from the CIA, the Aryan Brotherhood, and a double homicide was much more important to her than a few hours' sleep. She'd sit at her computer and dig around on Mays, Carmichael, and the mystery woman, and see what she could find. Chapter 9. Arthur Mayberry was nearly 70, and he looked it. Weather-worn, black skin, a silver mane of hair, and Coke-bottle glasses. He had been 11 Bravo Army Infantry back in Vietnam, and then he came home and drove a bus for Washington Metro Transit for 41 years while his wife worked her way up to food services manager at a hospital in Falls Church. Arthur sired 4 kids along the way, which made him a man rich in many blessings, but not in much else. Now he and his wife were grandparents and empty nesters, retired and living frugally in a large but rickety 2-story home in Columbia Heights. Prices in the district had skyrocketed in the past few years as the federal government became one of the few growth industries in America, and for this reason, Mayberry's property taxes had shot through the roof. Even though his street was one of the edgiest in Columbia Heights, which was one of the lower-end neighborhoods in the heart of the district, Arthur and his 68-year-old wife, Bernice, could barely afford their mortgage, so they'd taken to renting out a tiny and not exactly up-to-code basement bedroom for $250 a month. They'd recently lost their last tenant when he was arrested on a possession charge, so when the knock came at their front door first thing after church on Sunday morning, Arthur found himself hoping it was someone who'd seen the for rent sign stuck in the tiny front yard. This street was 70% African American and 22% Hispanic. There were as many Asians as there were whites, and the vast majority of the whites who lived around here were elderly, so Arthur's hopes that he'd get a new tenant today were effectively dashed when he looked through the peephole and saw a clean-shaven white man in a blazer standing alone on his stoop. Bernice came up beside him in the entryway. She was still wearing her hat from church.
Who is it?
Some man.
He's here about the room, she said confidently.
I doubt it.
Why do you say...
Arthur opened the wooden door, but left the storm door and its iron grating alone.
Oh,
his wife said, seeing the youngish Caucasian face on the other side of the storm door.
Yeah?
The white man spoke through the bolted door. Good morning.
Yeah?
Arthur repeated, the suspicion obvious in his voice.
I saw your for rent sign. Can I take a look at the room?
What the hell? Arthur thought. Arthur had no intention of renting to a white man. It wasn't that he was racist, but he was a realist, and no young white man in this area with a job would want to live in a tiny basement on this street.
Sir?
The man said after waiting 10 seconds for a response.
You from around here? No, sir. Just in from Michigan. My uncle had a place in Petworth, but he passed away. I'm in town for a couple of months, getting the house ready to sell.
Arthur softened just a little.
Sure sorry to hear about that. Thanks. What are you asking for the room?
A pause.
300. Really? I saw the notice you put on the board at the Giant up the street. It says 250.
Arthur stiffened right back up now.
Then why'd you ask?
A little smile from the white man.
I guess just to see if you'd rip me off.
Everyone stood awkwardly for a moment in the doorway till Mayberry said,
Well, now you know. Price went up. Take it or leave it.
Can I see it?
Arthur could feel an icy stare from his wife standing just next to him. Bernice was generally more suspicious of people than was Arthur, and considering Arthur didn't really believe this man's story, he assumed his wife was ready to kick the door shut in the man's face. But Arthur was thinking about the 300 bucks now, as well as the fact this guy could go and get a lawyer and make trouble if some black landlord refused to rent to him. Mayberry snatched his keys off the wall and headed out onto the porch. Bernice followed close behind, silently, but Arthur felt her misgivings. He knew if he rented the room to the man, she'd tell him he was a fool, because the man was probably out of work and on drugs. With a fatalistic sigh, he led his wife and the white man down to the driveway. Court almost didn't give a damn what the inside of the room looked like, because the outside was as close to perfect as he could hope to find from an operational security perspective. The entrance to the basement room was off the driveway, just 6 steps down to a tiny patio with a storm door that looked substantial, and on the other side of that was a wooden door that looked sturdy enough. There was just a small slit window at eye level, but it afforded a full view of the driveway, and, since this was a corner lot, he could use the window to see a good distance to the south, east, and north. Court and the Mayberries stepped into the basement room, and with 3 people there was little space to move around. It occurred to Court that there would be a bit more room to move if the heavy-set lady took off her huge hat, but he made no mention of it. Instead, he checked the space over quickly. It was just 10 feet by 10 feet with a tiny bathroom off the back, a kitchen counter that ran across the rear wall, and a knee-high refrigerator taking up floor space. It was obvious this setup had been built by hand. The cheap linoleum flooring buckled from water damage, and the paneling on the walls looked like a weekend project by the homeowner, and a water pipe ran across the middle of the room so that anyone over 5'6" would have to dip his head to move from the bed to the bathroom. But even with these limitations, it was as nice a place as any other Court had lived in the past few years, and better than most. The bed was just a twin, but it was all that would fit. There were a table and chair by the one little window, and even a small TV that looked like it was plugged into a cable box.
Cable?
Court wondered if he'd died and gone to heaven. On the southern wall, right behind where the front door opened, was an accordion door covering a small closet. The storage space was just 2 feet deep, but 6 feet wide. Court peered in and noticed the back panel of the closet was rippling, as if from moisture or excessive heat on the boards.
"What's all that?"
he asked.
"Oh, that ain't nothing,"
the landlord said.
"I built this room in a corner of my basement. The water heater and the furnace are on the other side of that wall.
Maybe I should have put a little more insulation in the wall or something, but it don't bother nobody who stays here.
Mayberry leaned into the closet and knocked on the wood.
See? It's solid.
It sounded hollow as a drum to Court, but he considered that a feature, not a glitch. The basement would have access to the main house, which meant Court would just have to make a small adjustment in that wall, and he'd have an escape route in case someone he didn't like came to the front door. Court looked around the room again.
I like it, he said. Didn't get your name.
Court was always quick with a name and a story, though like his trip from Michigan and his dead uncle in Petworth, it was never the truth.
Jeff. Jeff Duncan.
Got to ask, Jeff, how come you ain't staying up at your uncle's place?
I won't be able to afford the property taxes on the house, so I'll have to sell it. But before I put it on the market, I'll be doing some renovations. Have to shut off the water and heat while I work on the plumbing and the HVAC.
Court saw the older black man soften to him even more. It was basic social engineering. Court would say things to create an instant bond between himself and his potential landlord. When the man replied with,
I know that's right. Taxes are through the damn roof. It's gotten real bad around here.
Court knew he was in with the man, but Court noticed the wife was still gaping at him like he was a fucking unicorn.
It's $300 a month for the room?
Court asked.
That's firm,
the man replied.
Court pretended to think it over. Then he said,
I can give you first and last month's rent. Will that do?
The old man was on the spot. He clearly didn't expect an offer. He stammered for a moment, then said,
No room in the driveway for your car. Hard to find parking around here.
No problem. I'll keep my car parked at my uncle's.
The man bit his lip. He glanced to his wife, then said,
Not much of a kitchen. Toilet runs a little bit. TV is just basic cable.
That's all I need.
Okay, then, Arthur said.
Then,
Of course I'm gonna need to see your driver's license, run a background check.
Court smiled a little.
What do you say we make it $400 a month?
Despite the fact that he was being offered $150 more per month than he'd originally been asking, Mayberry frowned.
Son, I can't allow no criminals in here.
Not a criminal, Mr. Mayberry. Just a guy who's hoping to avoid some red tape.
Well, that's a problem, because I'm by the book. I guess this place isn't for you.
Court turned his head back and forth, scanning the small room.
You're right. By the book is best.
That's what I say.
Cool. Can I take a quick look at the back door?
The what?
The back door?
Just the one door.
Huh, Court said.
I could have sworn building codes say private apartments have to have two exits in case of fire.
I could be wrong, though.
How about while you are running that background check on me, I check with the city to make sure you've complied with all the building and zoning laws. That way we both know what we're getting into here. The African-American man glared at the white man for a long moment. Court smiled.
Like you said, by the book.
Bernice reached out and took her husband by the arm, giving it an anxious squeeze. Slowly the corner of Arthur Mayberry's mouth rose, and he smiled a wide, toothy grin.
All right, then. You're gonna have it your way, and I'm gonna have me $500 a month, plus $250 security deposit.
Court calculated he'd have to burn this tiny room to cinders to do $250 worth of damage, but with a little smile, he reached for his wallet.
A hard bargain, sir, but I like your style.
Bernice spoke up for the first time, and apparently none of the new mutual respect between the two men had rubbed off on her.
I'll tell you right now, young man, we're not going to stand for no parties.
Court had never thrown a party in his life, but still he wondered how much of a party one might actually throw in a 10x10 basement with a metal water pipe running across at forehead height.
I'll be gone a lot. I guarantee I'll be the quietest tenant you've ever had.
And no drugs,
the woman added.
Absolutely not.
Jeff Duncan handed Arthur Mayberry $1,250 and took a key, and when Arthur asked the younger man when he would actually move in, Jeff replied he'd been up all night, so he'd go right to bed, and then bring some things over from his hotel that evening. Arthur and Bernice left him in his new apartment and headed back to the front of the house. As soon as the storm door shut, Bernice said one word.
Drugs.
You're probably right, replied Arthur. Plaintively, he added, but what was I gonna do? First and last month's rent ain't nothing to turn your nose up to, and all that bonus money.
Bernice made a clicking sound with her tongue and said it again.
Drugs.
Arthur sighed. He knew he'd be hearing this a lot over the next 2 months. Court wedged one of the metal chairs under the door, and then he took a shower, his first in days. He took the .380 pistol into the stall with him, leaving it in the soap niche. There was no soap or shampoo, so all he really did was rinse off, and there were no towels, so he did little more than drip dry, although he patted himself down with the thin comforter from the bed. He put his clothes back on, even his shoes, and then he pulled a pillow and a wool blanket off the bed and threw them in the long, narrow closet behind the door to the outside. He rolled the damp comforter around the remaining two pillows, and he put them under the bedsheet in the center of the bed, making an approximate man-sized shape under the sheets. He turned off the lights in the room, walked over to the blanket and the pillow in the closet, and laid down, drawing his pistol from his pocket and putting it on the linoleum floor to the right of his body. He thought about the locks on the door and the wedged chair. This wasn't exactly a high-security facility, but he was dead tired and he could barely think. Anyone who kicked open the door would see the bed, and Court hoped they would assume someone was sleeping there. They would open fire on this target first, giving Court a little warning. They wouldn't see Court here in the closet until they stepped a few feet into the room and looked to their left, at which point Court would shoot them dead. That was the plan, anyway. Court wondered if he'd even wake up at the sound of a shattering storm door. And of course, most attackers came in pairs, or in long lines of jocked-up operators, and his little .380 pea shooter wouldn't do much more than kill the point man and maybe one of his buddies. No, this wasn't much defense at all, but Court realized he needed to try to get his energy back before doing anything else to fortify the room. So he lay there with his eyes closed and tried to will himself to sleep. He'd been on the go for over a month, moving from place to place in Russia, in Sweden, in Germany and Belgium, then to Spain and into Portugal, where he met up with the cargo ship that brought him to the U.S. 8 days on the water, the daylight hours in his hiding place in the bowels of the ship like a bilge rat, the late nights walking or running the holds for exercise. He'd had help in his escape, a Mossad officer who felt like he owed Court a debt, though in truth, Court knew the man owed the debt to someone else. Still, the guy worked as Court's genie in a bottle, granting him his wish and getting him into the United States. Court had decided he'd have no more dealings with the Mossad officer. Court knew personal relationships were points of vulnerability, so his plan all along had been to use the man as a conduit into the U.S. and then to break contact, to go his own way. He'd done exactly that by leaving everything behind on the cargo ship, save for the clothes on his back. He hadn't planned it exactly that way, but he heard the helicopters approaching, and he knew they were coming for him. On shore, he hot-wired a car and drove it to the Greenbelt metro station on the outskirts of D.C. He used some coins he found in the car's ashtray to buy a metro card that got him as far as the Congress Heights station. He needed cash and a weapon, and he knew this area would afford him the most target-rich environment in which to obtain both. He got what he'd been after, and now he had a suitable base of operations, at least for the time being. He knew it was possible he'd have to relocate multiple times during the next few days, but he'd do what he could to keep this new safe house free of compromise. court's mission here in Washington, as he saw it anyway, was very simple. His former employer, the Central Intelligence Agency, had spent the last 5 years trying to kill him, and he did not know why. He'd been running all that time, living abroad, off-grid, staying away from relationships and ties, looking over his shoulder all day, every day. They'd almost caught him a few times, and during his flight from the agency, other entities out there had come even closer to killing him. He had grown tired of running, so he decided it was time to end this, once and for all. In his years of small unit tactics training, he had learned a great many truths, but one stood out from the rest. When the opposition attacked, it expected you to play your role, to run, to cover. But turning the tables, attacking into a threat, was often the most useful way of defending oneself. Court's principal trainer at CIA, a man he knew only as Maurice, used to say a mantra over and over, so often Court now heard it in Maurice's gravelly voice.
"You can run, but if you can't run anymore, then you can hide. You can hide, but if you can't hide anymore, then you can fight. There is nothing after the fight. So, you fight until there is nothing."
Court couldn't run anymore, and he couldn't hide anymore. So, he came back to fight. To attack into the threat, to get answers, and to get closure. He knew he would not be leaving D.C. without a resolution to this nightmare. Either he would uncover the CIA's motives behind the shoot-on-sight sanction against him, and somehow end the sanction, or else he would die trying. He had come up with a working theory as to what this was all about. At the beginning of Court's career with the CIA, he had been part of a small initiative called the Autonomous Asset Program. He and several other young men like him had been given individual instruction by a cadre of the CIA's best operations officers, and then they had been sent into the world, allowed to run solo ops, tasked with difficult, deniable missions, and left in large part to their own devices. The program was disbanded. Court was folded into another unit, and other than the fact that he had been given better solo training than the other CIA Special Activities Division men, the Autonomous Asset Program was behind him. But Court had just found out the previous month that he was the last man alive from this entire program. 17 other young men had all been killed in the intervening years and, by necessity, Court himself had killed the only other remaining singleton asset out there. Court saw it clearly now. For some reason, the CIA was erasing anyone who had been in AAP. All the others were gone. And now it was down to Court Gentry, the last man standing. What he did not know was why. He could reveal what he knew about the program and the termination order for the assets, but first, he needed proof. Without proof, if he'd just called up the New York Times and told them what he suspected, he'd be considered a crackpot and there would be no story. The CIA would deny his allegations, and the CIA would win, because the CIA had significantly better media outreach than Court Gentry had. He needed proof. If he found proof, he would find justice, and that was what he was after. Not revenge, he told himself. Justice. There were men here in the area who Court felt sure would have the answers he sought. He had no illusions that they would give up their answers willingly, but Court was prepared. He'd seek these men out, find out what they knew, and rectify the mess his life had become. He told himself it was doable, that he wasn't naive, but part of him wondered if he'd just grown too tired of running, if he was racing headlong into his own death, just to end it all. He pushed the negativity out of his mind as best he could, and he drifted off just before 10 a.m., and, for the first time in months, he slept the sleep of the dead. Chapter 10. Denny Carmichael lay on the leather couch in his dark office, but his eyes remained open, fixed on the ceiling. He'd stayed up working until past 7 a.m. Then he slept for a couple of hours, but only fitfully. Now he lay awake, brooding and plotting, worrying and calculating. The door opened slowly, letting a little light into the room. This startled the director of National Clandestine Service. No one walked into his office unannounced. He had a vision of the gray man, his face darkened with coal, a hooked knife with a flat black finish in his hand, his eyes cold and dark and dead, like those of a snake. Carmichael rolled quickly up to a sitting position and reached out in the dark, finding and then pulling the chain on the banker's lamp on the desk. Jordan Mays stood over him with two cups of coffee.
"Sorry, I thought you'd be sleeping."
Carmichael rubbed his eyes and took a cup, and he motioned for Mays to take a seat on the other side of the coffee table.
"What time is it?"
"About 10 a.m., Mays said. "I'd have given you another hour, but I just got word from the homicide detective in charge in Washington Highlands."
"Talk."
Mays rubbed his own eyes, the all-nighter evident on his face.
"Brandywine Street was violator, no question."
"We know this how?"
"Fingerprints left at the scene."
Carmichael shook his head.
"Bullshit. PD doesn't have Gentry's prints on file. None of the Ground Branch boys are in any domestic database. Only we have his prints."
"I know that. The prints haven't been analyzed yet."
"Then how did the D.C. police?"
"Because Gentry wanted us to know it was him. He pressed his thumbprint onto a nightstand in the room where he left the bodies multiple times, leaving clear prints in the shape of a six."
Carmichael sat up straighter.
"Sierra Six. Gentry's call sign with the goon squad."
"It was a message. I'm back and I'm pissed. I want the agency to know I'm here."
Carmichael sat back on the sofa and blew out a full chest of air. A chill ran down the back of his neck and into his shoulders.
"Fucking brazen. He's not going to skulk around, then. I guess that means he won't be running, either. What did he take from the Aryan Brotherhood?"
"According to survivors, he got a bag full of cash. No agreement on how much. The narcotics detective I spoke with guessed about 10 grand, but that was just based on the size of the operation being run out of the house. PD recovered a lot of meth, apparently."
"That's it? Violator just took money?"
"None of the survivors copped to any more weapons than the half dozen or so found on the property, but that doesn't mean anything. He could have walked out of there with a bazooka and they wouldn't tell the cops, because that would mean they'd be keeping a bazooka in the house. The detective did find an empty ankle holster on one of the victims. It was sized for a subcompact pistol."
Carmichael ran his fingers through his short hair.
"Okay. Gentry's in the wind with a mouse gun and enough money to finance a small op."
Mays asked,
"What's he after?"
Carmichael just looked into his coffee.
"Revenge, I guess. I assume his next step is to make contact with known associates here in the area."
"Well, we're covered on that front. We've identified 4 possible contacts, people he used to work with in one capacity or another. We've put assets on them."
"Just 4?
"Most everyone he worked with is dead. We've got everyone covered, all except you and me, because we're here. Oh, and Zach Hightower, because he hasn't been located yet."
"What about Matt Hanley?"
"Right now, I have 4 contract security officers watching Hanley's house. When JSOC gets here, I'll put hard assets on him."
"Good. Gentry will go to Hanley."
Mays hesitated a moment and said,
"We need to get SAD involved in this. We can put 25 Ground Branch shooters in the mix with 1 call."
Carmichael shook his head.
"We can't involve Ground Branch without involving Hanley. I don't want anyone breathing a word to Hanley about this. We have enough armed assets without going to SAD.
"You really think Hanley is a threat to the operation?"
"No, but he's next in line to run NCS.
So? Asked Mays. When you take the directorship, he'll move up here. But you'll be the damn director, so why do you care?
I don't like the guy, and he doesn't like me. No, Hanley. You have guys watching him, that's it. Gentry will go to him, and that's where we'll get him.
So, we're using Hanley as bait.
It's the best way that prick can serve the agency.
Something occurred to Carmichael.
We need to watch Gentry's family, too.
His only close living relative is his dad. He's 64, lives in a little town in Florida. But they've been estranged since Gentry was a teenager.
I don't care. I want him covered.
Agency watchers are already in place. Hard assets would, of course, need to fly down there if Violator shows, but we can move them out of Fort Bragg, and that's no more than 90 minutes flying time.
Carmichael's secretary spoke over the intercom, telling him Suzanne Brewer was on the line. He asked her to put the call through, and seconds later, the voice of the 39-year-old targeting officer emanated from the speaker. Carmichael was customarily succinct.
Any word on the location of Zach Hightower?
Yes, sir. We'll have him in hand in a couple of hours. Do you want us to put him in a safe house?
No. I want him brought up here. Put the intimidation of the seventh floor in him. Let's see if he will play ball.
Yes, sir.
After Carmichael hung up, Mays said,
You want to stay here till he is brought in?
No.
Okay. I can schedule the movement to a safe house right now. You can get a little sleep before Hightower is brought in.
Carmichael looked uneasy a moment, an expression Mays wasn't used to seeing.
What is it?
Carmichael said,
I have to leave the building for a few hours. A meeting with an asset off-site. I need to go alone.
Mays stared at his boss for several seconds. Then he got up and closed the door. Standing back at the desk, he said,
You're joking, right?
I understand your concern, but it has to be like this. No one is to know but you and Dorenzi. I'm only telling you because you'll have to cover for me, and Dorenzi because he won't be able to shadow.
Mays remained incredulous.
Gentry's out there somewhere. You do know that, don't you?
You don't think I can do low pro anymore?
You aren't safe on the streets. Whoever you need to meet, we can set it up here with secure comms.
Has to be in person,
Mays said.
Then send me.
Carmichael just shook his head.
Look, Denny, if you've got a mistress or some shit like that, you need to put a cork in it until this all blows over.
Carmichael sighed.
If I had a mistress and you didn't know about it, you'd be a sorry excuse for an assistant director. I'll be out of pocket 3 hours. 4, tops. I won't have a phone, so you'll have to come up with something convincing.
Mays held the look of disbelief on his face.
Tell me you understand what's in the balance here.
Carmichael rolled his eyes.
Is this where you tell me Gentry is a dangerous man?
This is about more than Gentry, and you know it. You want the directorship. You've earned it. The one thing that can fuck that up is the Gentry story getting out. You won't just lose the directorship. You'll lose everything.
It's not going to get out, because we are going to handle this.
Mays pressed one more time.
You keeping me out of the loop is not a good idea.
Some burdens are my own, Mays, and that's just how it's going to stay.
The U.S. Army UC-35A jet touched down at Joint Base Andrews and taxied into a hangar on the far end of runway 36 right. Once the hangar doors were closed and the aircraft's wheels were chocked, the hatch opened and a set of rolling stairs was positioned by the ground crew. 12 men, all in their 30s and 40s, stepped down the stairs of the U.S. Army's version of the Cessna Citation V. Each man carried a massive black duffel bag over his shoulder, and, as soon as they vacated the stairs, they dropped their heavy bags onto the hangar floor. Although this was a military base and the UC-35A a military aircraft, The dozen men wore various styles of civilian clothing. Few soldiers would get away with such a transgression while on base and on duty, but this small force was no regular army unit. They were a cell of operators from Joint Special Operations Command, specifically an elite offshoot of JSOC, with a mandate to assist the United States on homeland security issues. There were two main direct action ground asset components of JSOC: the Navy men of DEVGRU, otherwise known as SEAL Team 6, and the Army men of the unit that for decades was commonly known as Delta Force. The unit members even used that name in open sources from time to time, but their classified designation had been changed. It was thought by the brass at JSOC that their operations and abilities had been compromised in the past few years due to an unprecedented spate of books, movies, articles, and interviews about and by Joint Special Operations personnel. So when they were given their new name, the name itself was code word classified. The Army boys of JSOC were happy to leave center stage to the Hollywood-loving Navy SEALs. JSOC had been on the Gentry hunt for years, but not this crew, because Gentry had been outside of the United States. These 12 operators worked inside the USA by special arrangement with the Department of Homeland Security. The 12 men in the hangar at Joint Base Andrews were tip of the spear of the military on domestic operations, so it only stood to reason they would get the call-up for this mission. Their brass had been contacted late the evening before by the CIA and told of the in-extremis mission to eliminate a rogue CIA man gone mad in D.C., and a short time later, these men rushed to their headquarters inside the wire at Fort Bragg, geared up, and boarded the waiting Army transport jet. 90 minutes after that, they were on the ground at Andrews, and now they unpacked and assembled equipment, loaded it into 3 nondescript Chevy Suburban SUVs, and headed to a safe house in the Capitol Hill section of D.C. The dozen men in street clothes didn't know much about the reasons behind the hunt, other than the facts that Violator was ex-agency, he'd gone off reservation, and he'd killed a bunch of his colleagues. The guys figured that was more than awkward and ugly enough to put you on a presidential kill list, so they didn't see the need to know more than that. The leader of this unit was a 43-year-old lieutenant colonel with the code name Dakota. Soon after he and his men arrived at their safe house, Jordan Mays, Suzanne Brewer, and the security detail traveling with Mays arrived at the front door. Mays, Brewer, and Dakota met for a briefing in the living room while the rest of the JSOC team prepped and tested their high-tech communications equipment in the dining room. Dakota took notes on a pad and asked relevant questions of the CIA officials, and together they went down a list of surveillance assets at their disposal. Then they discussed Violator's known associates and the other CIA brass who would need to have their homes watched in case their target tried to make contact with them. When Brewer indicated the briefing was complete, Dakota looked across the table to the two agency execs. He said, "We've done lethal ops in the U.S. before. Rare, but it's happened. Know this. If we go in, collateral damage will be limited or non-existent. Any other means you might use, local PD, federal SWAT, even CIA shooters, whatever assets you have available to you, they aren't going to be as precise as my men and myself. We have experience in doing this sort of thing quickly, cleanly, and quietly." Mays said, "Believe me, you are our first choice. Gentry has already committed 2 murders in the city. We are concerned that local police might run up on him before we do, but we will move you and your men to any sightings or possible sightings as soon as possible." Dakota stood, shook hands politely with the 2 CIA execs, and then said, "Very good. You get us to him, and we'll put him down. For now, we'll kit up and hit the streets. Let's stay in touch."
Chapter 11. Denny Carmichael climbed aboard a Bell Jet Ranger that was already spinning up in the parking lot at the CIA's McLean campus. Dorenzi was with him for this leg of the movement anyway. He threw an understandable fit when Carmichael told him he would run a surveillance detection route and then continue on to a meeting alone. But it wasn't Dorenzi's job to tell Director Carmichael what he could and couldn't do. So the close protection officer just made sure the Director of National Clandestine Service was wearing his .45 caliber HK semi-automatic pistol in his shoulder holster like he normally did. CIA officers virtually never carried firearms, but Denny had always been a different sort of animal from every other CIA officer around, and he often strapped a sidearm during movements, even in the States. The Jet Ranger landed at Washington Executive Airport in Prince George's County just 15 minutes after it took off, and there Denny left Dorenzi in the Hilo and climbed into a beige Toyota Highlander that another CIA employee had positioned in the parking lot with the keys under the mat. He drove out of the airport grounds and into late-morning traffic, heading north on the 210 back towards D.C. He kept his eyes in his rear view, and he turned east on I-95, and only after he was sure there was no one on his tail did he get off the freeway and head back west. He took the Woodrow Wilson Bridge over the Potomac into Alexandria, Virginia, and there he spent 20 minutes driving through the narrow streets of the Old Town section on a surveillance detection route. After 50 minutes in the vehicle, he parked on King Street and continued his SDR on foot. He meandered through the neighborhood for 30 minutes, wandering into gift shops and antique stores, heading down side streets and then back up again on the other side. At 12:15, he stepped into a sandwich shop and ordered a pastrami on rye. Eating his lunch at a counter by the window, he kept his eyes out on the street, all the while searching for anyone who might be following him. His trained eyes saw nothing out of the ordinary, so at 12:30 he threw the remainder of his sandwich away, headed north on King Street, and then ducked into the courtyard in front of the Kimpton Lorien Hotel. Once in the lobby, he walked straight to the counter and asked for a suite for one night with an early check-in. He used a credit card from a cover identity he kept ready, and the woman behind the counter gave him the card key to his fourth-floor suite. He stepped around to the bank of elevators behind the check-in desk, and while he did so, a distinguished-looking man stepped out of the men's room and walked over to the elevator bank to wait alongside him. The two men stood in silence as the car delivered them to the fourth floor. There, Denny walked down the hall to his suite, and the other man followed. No words were exchanged. They entered the suite together, and Denny shut the door. The man who shadowed him was in his early 50s, lean and handsome in his gray pinstripe suit. Olive-skinned and delicately featured, he had a kind, gentle bearing about him, in sharp contrast to the stern manner of Denny Carmichael. Only when the door was shut behind the two men did the olive-complected man offer a handshake to the American. He spoke perfect English with only a slight accent.
"Nice to see you, Denny."
"Hello, Kaz."
Carmichael turned away, took a cell phone-sized device out of his pocket, and turned it on. He headed to the center of the room and placed it on a coffee table. It was a radio-frequency signal jammer designed to block the transmissions given off by eavesdropping devices. While he did this, Kaz took off his suit coat and hung it over a chair, and then he moved to the sofa. There, he sat calmly and watched Denny adjust the instrument. Kaz was not his name, but Denny had called him this for 15 years, because Kaz was easier to say than Merkin Al-Kazaz. He was now chief of station here in the United States for Riyasat al-Istikbarat al-Amma, the intelligence agency of Saudi Arabia. But the two had known each other since back when Kaz was a lowly operative in Saudi intel. The Saudi smiled when watching Denny.
"Clandestine meetings in hotel rooms. This feels like the good old days, my friend."
Carmichael replied brusquely.
"Don't romanticize the past. It wasn't any better than the present."
While talking, Denny pulled out his mobile phone and slipped an earpiece in his ear.
"We were younger, at least. I romanticized my youth, regardless of how I might have misspent it."
Denny tried to send music from his phone to his earpiece, but he couldn't get a signal to go through. Satisfied that his jammer was operational, he pulled the earpiece out of his ear and slipped it, with his phone, back into his coat. Kaz said,
"You must have gone to some trouble to come and see me like this on a Sunday afternoon. Tell me, what is it that could not have been handled through a secure phone call?"
Denny ignored him for the moment, took his time to turn on the TV in the adjoining bedroom, then returned to the living area and turned on the flat screen there. The televisions were set to different stations. An action movie in the bedroom and a news interview program in the living area blanketed the entire suite with conflicting sounds. Denny sat down on the sofa close to Kaz, and he spoke softly.
A wayward asset has returned to the United States. To Washington, in fact. One of yours or one of mine? Used to be one of mine.
Codename Violator, perhaps?
Carmichael looked carefully at Kaz's face, struggling to see any hint the Saudi knew this information already.
That is correct.
Kaz looked neither surprised nor unsurprised. His face was a cipher, betraying nothing but pleasant calm. He said,
A bold move on his part. I am sure this is troublesome for you, but I hope you see this as an opportunity. He has been out in the four winds of this earth for some time, and now he is here, on your turf.
D.C. is not my turf.
Kaz raised his eyebrows.
By saying that, you mean to say, it's my turf.
That's right. It's yours.
Alcazar smiled a little.
A fact you remind me of from time to time. I don't know why you invited me here, but if it's a confession you want, I assure you I had no knowledge of Gentry's movements. Perhaps you should talk to your dear friends the Israelis. Doesn't the great Mossad know all things at all times?
Kaz was an enemy of the Israelis, and whenever he spoke with Carmichael, he never passed up an opportunity to get in digs about the United States' good relationship with them. In the intelligence sphere, Israel, the United States, and Saudi Arabia formed an incredibly awkward love triangle. Carmichael said,
I'm not after a confession. I know you were not aware that Violator was here. What I need from you is action.
Sounds exciting,
Kaz said with a smile that appeared more than a little sarcastic. Carmichael didn't hide the fact that he was losing patience with the flip attitude of the other man.
I don't have time to play. We both know exactly what's at stake here.
As far as I can tell, the only thing at stake with the arrival of Violator,
Kaz paused, his mouth morphed into a smile,
is you, Denny. Surely you realize that he is here for you.
Whatever his intentions, I plan on terminating him. In the city. I will have other tools at my disposal for this, but I need you and your people involved as well.
Kaz shook his head. Out of the question. The leadership of my nation has me quite busy at the moment. Nothing that would interest you, I can assure you of that, but I'm not in a position to retask my assets to your needs at this time.
Denny loomed a little closer.
You and I have a good working relationship. You give me some space for my people in the Middle East. I give you space for your people here in D.C. I want that relationship to continue.
As you said, it is a good relationship. Why on earth would it not continue?
If the Gentry situation isn't handled quickly and quietly, I'll be the one taking the fall, and I will fall hard. You think the next man in my position is going to allow the same arrangement with Saudi Arabia that I've allowed?
Denny leaned closer.
No fucking way. You'll be expelled. Your cell here doesn't have dip immunity, so they will be rounded up and tossed into prison, if not tossed into an unmarked grave.
Kaz said, Threats of death and destruction, really, Denny? Those who complain about you, and excuse me for saying so, but there are many, all say the same thing, that you don't possess the nuance for intelligence work. I defend you, you know, but opening the conversation with an overt threat to our long-standing agreement is exactly the boorishness that others accuse you of.
Denny said nothing, waiting the other man out.
Kaz calmed. Look, dear friend, you are correct. Our mutual relationship is good for everyone. When our countries are friends, things are good. When you and I are friends, things are great.
Then help me.
What is it you want?
I want you looking for him, you and your team.
Kaz blew out a sigh.
Who else do you have hunting him?
Agency and military assets. but I need more. I need your best men.
Sounds like a crowded playing field. That makes it dangerous for my men.
I can keep you aware of other entities involved in the hunt. You can vector your assets away from American assets when necessary.
Carmichael then asked,
How many men do you have working in D.C.?
Apologies, but that is something I would rather not say.
10, Carmichael said. You have 10. I want them all on this. If you want to bring others in, I can facilitate that.
Kaz seemed reluctant, but after a few moments he acquiesced.
Professional trust and good manners are two things I don't seek in this line of work. But you and I, Denny, we have shared interests. I will help you in this, provided you return the favor to me, somehow.
Carmichael had been expecting this.
You help us find Violator, and you have my word you will have more latitude in the district. You won't be off the leash, but I will let a little slack out of the leash, so you can sniff around the yard a little more.
Kaz nodded.
Carmichael then said, I am sure you realize Gentry can't be taken alive.
Kaz reached out and patted Carmichael on the arm.
If we get to him first, he won't be.
Kaz stood, extended a hand.
Let us work together to finally put an end to this difficult affair.
Excellent. You and I will deal directly. I'll let you know what I know as soon as I know it.
Kaz stood and reached for his suit coat. Slipping it on, he said,
I do have some advice in the short term.
What advice?
Get off the streets. If Gentry is within 10 miles of you right now, you are in peril driving yourself around.
My relationship with you is unsanctioned, Kaz. I can't just roll with a detail into the Saudi embassy.
Then let's pretend it's the old days, in Lebanon, or in Sana'a, or in Tunisia. You and I can play the role of young field operatives, dead drops and coded messages.
Carmichael wiped his eyes under his glasses. He was already fighting sleep deprivation, and he expected no real rest until Gentry was located and terminated.
Don't be dramatic, Kaz. I'll use the secure mobile. It's on my person at all times. Keep yours with you.
The Saudi shrugged, feigning disappointment.
Very well.
The men left separately, Carmichael first. He'd have one of his people drop by the hotel in the evening and spend the night, then check out in the morning using the hotel services screen on the television so he did not have to go to the reception desk and do it in person. The automated world of travel made some things easier for spies. Chapter 12. Carmichael returned to the Highlander parked on King Street. Then he began a new SDR that would lead him, eventually, to the helicopter and Dorenzi at the airport. He'd be back at Langley by 3 p.m., and only then would he and Maze both breathe a long sigh of relief. As he drove, he thought of the unprecedented challenge before him. Find one man in a metropolitan area of 6 million. Killing the gray men had been a top priority for the past 5 years, and still, he had failed to accomplish it. In those same years, he had directed human intelligence assets all over the globe, assassinated high-value targets in remote locations, successfully executed major intelligence operations against world powers, thwarted terrorist attacks on the homeland, and even a hand in winning a regional war in Africa. But Cortland fucking Gentry somehow managed to remain alive. He'd been a hard target for a long time, but now Carmichael was certain Gentry had miscalculated. Whatever it was he thought he would accomplish here, there would be no escape from the United States. Not with Kaz and his men involved. Carmichael had allowed Kaz to run a small team of operatives in D.C. for 3 years now. Carmichael had even helped Kaz steer clear of FBI counterintelligence schemes designed to identify and arrest foreign operatives in the U.S., alerting his Saudi colleague to sting operations. And no one knew. Not the FBI, not the director of the CIA, not even Jordan Mays. Mays was aware his boss had a good working relationship with the director of Saudi intelligence in the U.S., but he had no idea of the quid pro quo that existed between the two men. It was entirely against the law, an unsanctioned relationship, but Carmichael wasn't interested in rules. He was interested in results. In return for this, Kaz fed Carmichael intelligence of the quantity and quality no American intelligence chief had ever been given by an Arab nation. Kaz had personally passed Denny Al-Qaeda bank account numbers in Dubai, names and addresses of